That's good to be with you. And I think at the end of the time of Bible readings, etc., I do feel it would be neat to finish it off by turning your attention to Genesis, reading firstly in chapter number 13. Chapter number 13, please, of the book of Genesis. And reading at verse number 18. I suppose if I adopted the method of the writer, Paul, when he was writing to the Hebrews, I would say, turn to that certain place which deals with the first mention of Melchizedek. But we're going back a little earlier, and we're turning to the 18th verse of chapter number 13. Then Abram removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Lord. And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Adma, and Shinebar, king of Zeboam, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. All these were joined together in the vale of Siddim, which is the salt sea. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. And in the 14th year came Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him, and smote the Rephaims in Ashtaroth-Karnaim, and the Zuzims in Ham, and the Emims in Shabbath-Kiriathim, and the Horites in their Mount Seir unto El-Paran, which is by the wilderness. And they returned and came to En-Mishpat, which is Kadesh, and smote all the country of the Amalekites, and also the Amorites that dwelt on Hazazon Tamar. And there went out the king of Sodom, and the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Adma, and the king of Zeboam, and the king of Bela, the same as Zoar, and they joined battle with them in the vale of Siddim, with Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, and with Tidal, king of nations, and Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, 4 kings with 5. And the vale of Siddim was full of slime pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there, and they that remained fled to the mountain. And they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah, and all their victuals, and went their way. And they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. And there came one that had escaped, and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner, and these were confederate with Abram. And when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house, 318, and pursued them unto Dan. And he divided himself against them, he and his servants by night, and smote them, and pursued them unto Hobah, which is on the left hand of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot, and his goods, and the women also, and the people. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him, after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer, and of the kings that were with him at the valley of Shaveh, which is the Kingsdale. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand. And he gave him tithes of all. And the king of Sodom said unto Abram, Give me the persons, and take the goods to thyself. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abram rich. Save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, let them take their portion. After these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abram in a vision, saying, Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield, and thy exceeding great reward. Now God will bless the public reading of the sacred scriptures to us this evening. If you care to turn your attention and read the 13th chapter of the book of Genesis, you will be immediately struck with the fact that when you come into chapter 14, there is a complete change of atmosphere. When we are lingering on the 18th verse of chapter number 13, we have Abram removing his tent and coming and dwelling in the plain of Mamre, which is Hebron. Now that was a place where Abram enjoyed fellowship with God. And now there is almost, as it were, a little lull in the life of Abraham as we just linger for a moment or two in the beauty of chapter number 13 and verse 18. And if I was to put a little heading over that, I would say quite simply that over that there is a time of calm. And it was indeed, in a sense, the calm before the storm. So there is there just that little time of calm at the end of chapter number 13. But when we turn into chapter 14, let me say again, the whole atmosphere has changed. It is now not the calm of the elevated place. It is not now the tent dweller in Hebron. It is not now the man enjoying the fellowship of God there up in the plains of Mamre. But when you turn into chapter number 14, the atmosphere, let me say again, I think for the third time, has changed dramatically and changed completely. As you read down chapter number 14, it is not the sweet solace of the presence of God you hear and you see, but it is the tramp of marching feet. And when you go down a little further, you will find that there is the clash of sword against sword. And move a little further, and you will see that there is the thud of arrows finding their mark and reaching their home. And if you go a little further, you will see that there is the clatter of hoofbeats, and there is the cries and shouts of command, and there is the trumpet call of the armies. And if you follow the chapter, this caravan of death that moves down the east side of the seas, down there to the Gulf of Aqaba, and back up again to the south of the land of Canaan, this caravan of death, this invading army, this alliance of great powers leaves behind it a scene of death and destruction and despair and defeat. We are introduced in chapter 14 to the first war of the Bible. And I want this evening just to pull up some lessons from that. Now you might say to me, preacher, have you never heard of Nimrod, the mighty hunter? You know, when I was a little younger, and my boys were a little younger, well, they had nicknames for speakers in Scotland. You probably had them over here as well. Now, I don't need to tell you who Nimrod was. And when they were looking up that magazine that you must all buy, called the Believer's Magazine, they would say, why, Nimrod is speaking somewhere. They were speaking about the mighty hunter. He was very amused to hear that, was our brother Jack. And at one occasion he used it against himself on the platform within my hearing. But nevertheless, you go back to Nimrod and you see there why that great empire builder. But of course, there is no war as such mentioned in his, although no doubt he was a hunter and probably primarily a hunter of men. But nevertheless, here we have the first war of the Bible. So from calm, we move to conquest. And in chapter number 14, we have a chapter of conquest, three battles in chapter 14 of the book of Genesis. And to these battles this evening, I wish to direct your attention. But you might say, preacher, why did you read the first verse of chapter 15? Why it seems to end in a high at the end of chapter number 14? Why read the 15 and the first verse? Because we move from calm to conquest to concern. And in the heart of Abram, there was concern which bore fruit in an anxiety about certain things to which I will direct your attention this evening. So there we have a brief outline of where we're going, so that you will know that. They say of every preacher, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. So if the preacher knows where he's going, at least you know where he starts, where he is in the middle, and when he ends. So it is calm, followed by conquest, and followed by concern. Now, of course, I've mentioned all I want to mention about that calm period, and I turn your attention now to this 14th chapter. Let me say again, the first international dispute and war in the Bible. You will find, as I say, that there are three battles here. There is the great battle between the alliance from the east and the alliance from Canaan. And I would say that that was a battle of international dispute. So there we have the first battle, one of international dispute. And then we move and there is a second battle. Abraham with his 318 retainers, plus no doubt his three confederates and allies, pursuing the victorious armies, and there's a second battle. And that is a battle over which I place the heading, individual determination. This is the battle of Abram the Hebrew, a battle spurred on by the individual determination of this man to rescue his brother's son, Lot. But there's a third battle. You say, preacher, I don't hear the clash of arms, and I don't hear the tramp of marching men, and I don't hear the clatter of hoofbeats. No, but I tell you, there was a battle just as real, and just as true, and just as important. It is the battle when the king of Sodom meets the returning Abram. And over that, I place the heading, a battle of intelligent discernment. So you've got a little heading, international dispute, and an individual determination, and then intelligent discernment. Well, let's go through that as time allows. I want you to come now to this first great battle. I want to look at three things. I want to look at the background, and then I want to look at the battle, and then I want to look at the boundary. Let us think first of all of the background to this battle. Now you will see it was more than a battle. It culminated in the great battle in the place of the slime pits, but it was a protracted military campaign. I want to look at the background and find the cause of this. Why, for 12 years, the Great Eastern Alliance had held the kings of Canaan in sway. They were in servitude to this great Eastern Alliance. It is recorded in verse 4 that 12 years they served, or they had served, Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. It's interesting if you trace the dates to see that this servitude was in place when the God of glory appeared unto Abram and out of the Chaldees. Even at that time, Chedorlaomer and his allies held the kings of that area and to the south of Canaan in sway. But nevertheless, in the 14th year they rebelled. Now look please at the two alliances and observe the constitution. I don't mean the constitution politically, I mean the makeup of these alliances. On the one hand, you have Shinar. That's of course where Babylon was. And then you have Elasar. And look at any map and you'll see that that was to the east of Babylon. And then you have Elam. Elasar near Babylon. Elam a little more to the east. And then you have Tidal, king of nations, who no doubt was the king of the nomadic nations that moved around that area. So you've got the picture of that alliance. It is centered round the Babylonish area. And so there is a great confederation of military power. There are these kings of Shinar, Elasar, Elam, and Tidal, king of nations. And to whom are they opposed? Well, there is the king of Sodom, and the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Zeboam, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. These kings that are centered round Sodom and Gomorrah. Are you building a picture? On the one hand, there is an alliance that would be, in inverted commas, the good people, the culture people, the civilized people, the religious people. Here is an alliance of what the world would call the civilized powers of the day. But turn your attention to the other alliance, and you'll find that it represents the very dark, perverted baseness to which the human heart can sink. So you've got one alliance, which is the good alliance, and I put that in inverted commas, my brethren understand that, and one alliance that is the bad
a line,
and I put that in vertical. My brothers and sisters, that was the character of war in the first war of the Bible. That's still the character of war today. Now, I am excluding the wars in which Israel was concerned. I'm thinking of when Gentile powers fight Gentile power. It is in Genesis 14, the civilized seeking to suppress the depraved. It is in Genesis 14, those who would be regarded as the good seeking to suppress the evil. And that always has been the character of the war. That's been the character of war in our present dispensation. When nations rise against nations, and when Gentile nations do war together, why, more often than not, we see that some folk regard one side as being the good side and the bad side. I could never understand. My history teacher at school, not so many years ago, James Dinning by name, and he dinned it into you. You wrote everything down, and then he would stand, and he would say next week, Grant 1534. If you couldn't tell him, well, you wrote it out 250 times. And by that time, when he said, Grant 1534, you knew it inside out, backside forward, upside down. You really did. Well, you know, he used to always, every single war, the war of the Spanish Succession, the war of Jenkins' ear, you know about these things here, I'm sure. And all the great wars that took place between Scotland and England, the sacking of the White Tower at Berwick, you know all about that, if you don't buy a book. But nevertheless, he always said that was the good and that was the bad. And he always had the good in red, for some reason, and the bad in blue. Well, he never had white in, but nevertheless, there he was keeping his balance, and it was always the good and it was always the bad. So it always has. My brethren and sisters, character of war hasn't changed. Just a week or two ago, some nations crossed the Rubicon again. Remember, it is the good suppressing the evil. You say, where is Abram in it? Where are the saints in this, if we bring it up today? Oh, they're not in it yet. Just bear with me. That's always been the character. Always will be. And so the great battle takes place. As I say, that caravan of death, the tramp of marching feet as they come from the east, down there through the east side, conquering who? They conquered the Rephaims, and they were giants. And they conquered the Zuzans. They were roving creatures. In other words, they were difficult to find. You couldn't nail them down. They were roving creatures. They no doubt were kind of guerrilla fighters up here and up there. And they conquered them. And they conquered the Edoms. They were a terror, it is said. The very name indicates that a terror struck fear into the heart of everybody. And they conquered the Horites, the cave dwellers, and the Amalekites that came from Esau, and the Amorites. They conquered all these nations. And that victorious army, leaving death in its wake, march down probably to the Gulf of Aqaba, turn north again, up towards Kadesh Barnea, and emerge victorious from the battle. The good had suppressed the evil. That always is the character of war. Now I want you to observe, please, how the battle took place. That's the background. Now observe the actual battle itself. It is recorded about this final great conclusive battle that it took place in the vale which was full of slime pits. And Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there, and they that remained. My brethren and sisters, drive that into your mind. Now, there will be spiritual lessons to take from this, but bear with me as I go through. So there is that these three words in verse number 10, and they that remained. I want to tell you, men of wars, of course, no, I was going to say some will remember, not maybe some will remember, some may. I don't. Although I was speaking to a brother 5 years ago, who remembered the day the First World War started. He could tell me where he was and when he saw the announcement in a billboard. That was the war to end all wars, you see, that was what they said. A war to end all wars that would create a land fit for heroes. But no matter how the good seeks to suppress the evil, from the evil there is always them that remain. Doesn't do it, you see. Doesn't finish it off. We'll see later. The king of Sodom's still alive. And we will see later that when it comes to the destruction of evil and Sodom, it has to be the hand of God that finally has done with it. And it's God's hand that has done with it. Good number, probably about 15 years old. While the fire came down and the brimstone came down and the judgment of God fell on them. I tell you, men may seek to eradicate evil from this world, but it will not be eradicated until he destroys them with the brightness of his hand. And on that day, he will eradicate evil. He will destroy. Millennium glory will come. Now, just think about that battle, as I say, and there were those that remain. That's the first battle. But there's a second battle. There came one that escaped and told Abram the Hebrew. Now, if you were here the other evening, Tuesday, was it? You know what that word Hebrew means. The one who crossed over, the river crossing. Is the river crossing. The first mention, as we heard the other evening, of this in the Bible. There came one that escaped and told Abram the Hebrew. Now, why is Abram the Hebrew? He's a separated man. He's not involved in this. There was nothing in the life of Abram to excite the cupidity of these kings. Nothing at all. He was separate from it all. He was still there in Hebron, in Mamre. He was above the whole thing. He hadn't descended into this battle. He had no part of it. But Lot, his brother's son, living down there in Sodom, had been carried away with the whole business. The second one. Well, you say, preacher, are you suggesting that we take up arms to help the saints? No. Things have changed. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. What you have here is Abraham rescuing a brother who has been tied up with the things of the world to such extent that he is bearing their fate. That's a bad word to do, that shouldn't be. But he is having the same circumstances placed upon him as they do. He's got to rescue them. Rescue a brother from the world and his consequences. You don't do that. But Abraham had a heart for Lot. I don't have time to say much about this. I want to get on to Melchizedek. Abraham had a heart for Lot. He desired to rescue him from the dreadful circumstances in which he found himself. And the second battle takes place. Do you notice? 318 men, plus no doubt the retainers of his three confederates. Isn't it good to see that probably Abraham had men who were certainly persuaded, I believe, as to the truth of the God of Abraham. Thus, he used them. They were confederates, they were allies, and they go with Abraham. 318 men plus some others, and they destroy a victorious international alliance. I tell you this. It's amazing what God can do with you. Going right through the Bible, now I'm going to take this completely out of context. But really, it's been interwoven throughout some of the ministry this week. You would say about that, that's a ragtag army to go after this victorious alliance. That's a ragtag bunch of nobody. Where were they on the day of crisis? It's just a ragtag bunch of folks who've got some kind of funny ideas about things. Well, they say that about local assemblies, don't they? just a ragtag bunch. Now, I use that expression, ragtag, because somebody actually said that to me about missing. They're just a ragtag bunch of funny people. Well, I had never been there, and I wondered what they would be like. I thought it meant they didn't wear suits, or something like that. But here, I found they did. And I found this, they were a powerful God. Just a few. Abraham wasn't put off by the immensity of the task. He wasn't put off by the fact that there would be a victorious army to meet him. I tell you this. When God was with him, they couldn't oppose him, and he's able to rescue his brother-in-law. Can I just appeal tonight? I hope there's nobody here who's doing what Lot did and pitching their tent towards Sodom. You see, it's possible to do it without realizing. You say, well, how do I pitch my tent towards Sodom? Well, I might pitch it in business by starting using worldly methods. I might decide that I would be disadvantaged by paying the real tax I should pay. And quite legitimate to put through. Seems a strange thing, isn't it? People don't seem to think that stealing is stealing for the government. You don't steal if you steal for the government. Folks in the world don't think that. They think, well, it's all right. You know, believers don't do that. You know. So you're pitching your tent towards Sodom all the time, you see. Or it may be that there's the things of the world. Maybe it's entertainment or maybe it's sport or something like that, and it's gripping you, and you're gradually pitching your tent towards Sodom. And then eventually you find it's inside. And the tent's not there and it's gone. And you're right in the middle of the whole thing. It's taken away. Now let's go on. Because I do want to get to this third battle, the most important one. In the middle of it all, we're coming now to the battle over which I put the heading. Why? Here is the battle of discretion, discernment, intelligent discernment. You see, if you read verse number 17 and 18, it's obvious that the king of Sodom comes out first to meet Abram. But Melchizedek intervenes. This tells me this. But Melchizedek knew Abram. Melchizedek knew he was coming. Melchizedek knew the movements of Sodom. The name King of Righteousness linked with King of Salem, King of Peace. And I want you to see, please, what the Word of God tells us about this man Melchizedek. Here we have the first mention of priest in the Bible. And this is a royal priest, God's original thoughts of priesthood. He's a king priest. And this is God's original thoughts of priesthood. And praise God, it will be seen one day in the Lord Jesus in all its fullness. The king priest. What a day that will be. I tell you, let me say again, I think somebody said in the platform, we should be looking forward to the manifestation as well as the rapture. Of course we should. The public vindication of the Savior. And then he will be seen truly as the king priest. This first priest in the Bible is a king priest. God's original thoughts of priesthood. I want you to notice, please, that this Melchizedek did four things for Abraham. Four things that he did. And just think now of priestly ministry. And I'm thinking that this is what is available today, for we have a great high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Now what did Melchizedek do for the warrior fighting down there? What did he do? First of all, he refreshed him. Do you notice that? He brought forth bread and wine. And he refreshed Abram. I do believe, my brethren and sisters, there is a refreshment for saints from that heavenly ministry of the great high priest, which is ours to enjoy today. He refreshed Abraham. Some of that refreshment, I was thinking yesterday, of silent years. And in silent years, we wouldn't appreciate the freshness and the refreshment of heavenly ministry for God's people on earth. Here is a high priest. And this high priest, this king priest, rather, this king priest, this priest of the Most High God, is refreshing the returning warrior. My brethren and sisters, we have a high priest who will refresh us in the battles and in the struggles of Christian testimony. You're not on your own. He knew the movements of Abram. He knew the movements of Sodom. He knows your movements. He knows the movements of the enemy. He knows what you're doing. He knows what the enemy's doing. He knows when you need refreshment. He knows when the enemy needs to be calmed. Feeling low. You're feeling it's just getting too much. It's a wee assembly and the burden's great. And it's not easy to carry it. And you're going on for God. And you feel the whole weight of the thing. I want to tell you this. There's a high priest, a great high priest who knows all about it. And there's problems in the family, or problems in the business, or problems of any kind at all. And you feel you're fighting a battle, and nobody knows anything about it. I tell you, there is a great high priest who understands. You understand. And there's a great high priest who refreshes. And he refreshed Abraham, and he brought forth bread and wine. Now, what was the purpose? Can I tell you? He not only refreshed him, but he strengthened him by the same act. He was strengthening Abram. Because Abram had to meet Sodom, the king of Sodom. And so he was strengthening and refreshing Abram. I tell you, there is a high priest, there are heavenly resources available to strengthen the saints of God. This is what he does as he comes. He is the priest of the Most High God. Now sometimes, when I hear folks on about the book of Genesis, they think there's only one or two men then who really were true worshippers of the God of glory. Now they maybe didn't know him as the God of glory, but, you know, there were other folks who bowed before the true God, you know. Abram wasn't alone. Here's another man. Here he is. Melchizedek. And I've no doubt that these who were allied to Abram had probably similar persuasion. So he wasn't alone. You have to think there was just one man. Now I know Abram is unique in that sense, and I'm not saying there were other men like Abram. Abram was picked up, here's the example. And Abram believed God, other men believed God, but Abram is taken up for an example. Here he is. My brethren and sisters, if the struggles are, you're going out of Lurgan, and it's been great to meet with the saints, but you go out there, and you gather on Sunday, and there's a dozen of you. And there might be 60 of you, 70, but there's problems to face. And it's fine when you're amongst the same. Just remember that great high priest. And there's infirmities and troubles surrounding you. Just remember, he's able to be touched. Sodom awaited Abraham, but Melchizedek, I believe, felt the very heartbeats of Abraham and understood the very thoughts of the heart of the returning Abraham. Understood that. Here he comes. I think of that. So he refreshed Abraham. So he strengthened Abraham. So he blessed Abraham. He blessed him. I have a funny feeling my four is going to become five. But nevertheless, I said four things. I think we can think of that. He blessed Abram. What does it mean? It's recorded. He blessed him and said, bless Abram of the Most High God. What's the significance? Blessing Abram, I suppose, when he blessed Abraham, it was to endue him with power for success, for longevity, and things like that. It was to do a man good. It was to impart to him. Remember, when God blesses us, he imparts to us. But when we bless God, we can add nothing to God. But he blessed us. You get the picture? Here is this returning warrior.
Abram was refreshed. Abram was strengthened. Abram was blessed. Not in a new way to him.
What do you mean? Well, spread your prayers, mighty. Tie gauze out, haven't I?
Well, that's you. Possessor of her?
Why? Is he?
Why is he possessor of her? Is he? Abram, you're going to meet a man who's going to offer you worldly wealth. I want to tell you the God in whom we trust. Everything belongs to him, Abram. You're going to be offered wealth. He's going to offer you the bounty of battle, which in a sense rightly is yours by the laws of engagement, as they talk of it. But nevertheless, Abram, remember, when he offers you, your God is the possessor of heaven and earth. Things mean nothing to him. So he reveals God. Now, I've got to be careful what I say to you, or else you'll chase me out of the room and bring a heretic. Oftentimes in the circumstances of life, God will reveal himself to you in a new way. I'm not saying a way that's not in the Bible. I want to qualify. There's no revelation beyond this Bible. But the truth of what God is and who God is in all his fullness, God will reveal that, and you know, sometimes in the trials of life, God reveals himself in a new way. Some of us together, I can see one or two faces, were looking a wee while back at the book of Exodus. And I spoke about going to Elam. And remember I said if there was ever a place that would look good in a tourist brochure, it was Elam. Oh, it was the place to be. After all, they had come through a place where there was no water, and where there was bitter water, but get to Elam, and it was absolutely perfect. And if you wanted to go on your holidays, you'd go to Elam. Who would say, we can recommend it. The palm trees, and the wells, and then they move away from Elam, and the trouble starts again. And they'd say, if you're ever going over there, pitch your tent to Elam. And we observe, what most will have observed, that in that journey, right there in Exodus, the places where they stop, the only place where they learn nothing new about God, Willem. That was the only place. The place where there was no trouble was the place where they learned nothing new about God. I'm speaking to somebody today, it's been a troublesome year. As the clock ticked over to January the 1st, you never imagined what it would be like. And I know saints are saying to me, I just hope if the Lord doesn't come and we're spared, next year isn't like this. It's hard going. Now, I'm not going to say I can enter into your circumstances. I'm not going to stand up here and say it's easy. And I'm not going to give you all the platitudes that folk have. I'm just going to say from the Bible that God often takes circumstances like that and teaches me what I didn't know before. And here's God revealed in a new way. The possessor of heaven and earth. It's an interesting thing, by the way, that Abraham had no national thoughts. After all, the alliance that came down to Canaan, which he chased in defeat, came from his home area. Came from his home area. That's where he came from. Ar was near Babylon. And so you see, these were folks who nationally came from about the same place as he did. And folks could have said, Abraham, you're doing battle against men who came from your own place, and naturally speaking, maybe of your own kind of blood strain, Abram.
Well, that wasn't the point. He's now Abram the Hebrew. And that rose above everything else. That rose above it. And now, what else did this man Melchizedek? Time's going on. I've been offered 2 or 3 Scottish minutes. Now, look please at something else he did.
he received tithes from Abraham.
Abraham vowed and gave this man a tenth of the spoils of battle. Tithe. He recognized that this was the priest of the Most High God. The teaching, as my brethren will know, the sort of the Hebrews, is used to confirm the fact that the Melchizedek priesthood is superior to the Aaronic. For, in the loins of Abraham, the Aaronic priesthood gave tithes, and indeed was blessed by Melchizedek. And he who blesses is greater than he who is blessed. This man is acknowledging the greatness of Melchizedek. Consider how great this man was. You see, folks sometimes say to me today, there's no question, isn't there, how much should I give? I know a fellow who uses a calculator to work it out. Every time he sends out an invoice, he does a calculation, individual in every invoice. And I couldn't understand that. I said, if you want a percentage, why don't you just add it all up at the end of the week? He says, what I do, I calculate it in every invoice and I round it down to the nearest pound. So, if I've got 100 invoices for the week, I maybe save myself a wee bit of money. You see? Well, he was honest, but anyway, wasn't he? Didn't he come from Ulster? He didn't come from Scotland? Well, I'm not giving away any secrets. He did come from the United Kingdom, he didn't come from Wales. But nevertheless, I think he's an exception to the rule in the area where he came from. I've got to say that. And I just thought of this man. And he said to me, I sometimes work to 1 o'clock in the morning over these invoices. And I said, can you check your calculation twice? Just in case you put in an extra 50p. Or something like that. And he actually said to me, how much should I give? I'll tell you how I do it. I said, you could save your... He says, I plugged my calculator in. I said, well, you could save yourself on some electricity, you see? Oh, dear me. You gave him... So, you see, a good Israelite gave a tenth. Stop the nonsense. A good Israelite gave a lot more than a tenth. Whoever told you he just gave a tenth? He had sacrifices to bring. There was lots of other things. And he could pledge himself and his house. And fuck, you know the law is right. You see, when the question comes up today about how much you give, the answer is very simple. You give everything. Now, I'm not meaning by that every penny you got, you give away to somebody else. But you regard every penny you have as belonging to Christ. Says, to be used for His glory. You need to feed yourself. You need a house. And you maybe need a wee bit of a car to run about. But I tell you this, it's possible for a millionaire to be a pilgrim and a stranger, and for a pauper to be so bound up to the things of earth that he's sitting his calculator working out how much is 10% of £1 from each. Now, what did Abram do? Just for realizing that this man Abraham had this great resource of the high priest of the, I keep calling him that, the priest of the Most High God. In giving tithes to Melchizedek, he was giving them to God. But then the great battle takes place. Do you see? Well, I've covered it. He did a number of things. He gave tithes to Melchizedek. We'll just cover that. Leave that behind. He received blessing from Melchizedek. And he refused the offer of Sodom. Give me the souls. And take the goods to yourself. It's as up today as today's news day. The devil can't stop you going to him. And what you have to ensure that you get there
save Noah's life back.
When we came to Christ for salvation, we brought nothing in our hand. Sad if we go to heaven with nothing. And here is this man. He says to Sodom, I'm not going to take from a thread to a shoe. Because you'll see I made him. The devil still seek and say, I can't have your soul. Well, let me into your life. And you can keep the goods to yourself. Do you see what it says? He gave a tenth to Melchizedek, and then Sodom says, keep the goods. Do you know what he's saying? This business of worshipping God is costly. It's costing you 10% of your bounty. I'm beneficent. I'll leave you with a lot. I need nothing. I'm not like your God. I don't take from you. Just you give me the souls, and you keep the goods. Do you know what he was saying? You give me the souls and keep the goods, and I'll get you as well. Young believer, the devil sometimes says to you, being a Christian's too expensive. Costs you too much in money. Costs you too much in time. Costs you too much in ambitions that maybe you'll need to lower a wee bit. Costs you too much in the pathway of life. The devil says, come to me and I'll leave everything with you and I'll make you rich. You know what I'm going to tell you? Every word he speaks is a lie. It is impossible for the devil to put a true suggestion into your mind. It's a costly business, this, isn't it? If you stick your hand in your pocket, or you could buy a meal for that, you could go out for that, instead of sticking your hand in. Or you could get a fancier cab for that. Or you could do this. Or you could get a bigger house for that. Or something like that. Stick your hand up. It's costing.
And we'll say, you can keep that for yourself, you know. Why would you take that from me? I'm reasonable. Just let me in. I'm reasonable.
And then time. An awful lot of time. You say, now, listen, young brethren and sisters. We want you to get down into the book to learn the book. Now, you're going to have to sit, and you're going to have to give time when others are around in their sport, and around in things that may not be sinful, but are absolutely destructive of time. And you're going to have to be the odd man and the odd woman out, and you're going to have to be that, and the devil will say to you, it's a waste of your time. You could be running, and you could be enjoying, and you could be doing this, and you could be, and you're stuck in a fusty old room, and you're reading a book, and you've got your online Bible or whatever you have, and that's all you've got. The devil will say, it costs too much, away and enjoy yourself. He's like, no. You never get to know the book by reading the calendar. You read the calendar, nothing wrong with it. Young brethren and sisters, assemblies desperately need the young to get into the book. And I'm appealing as I close this conference for you to get into the book. But I warn you, and I've written a warning on it, I warn you, you start getting into the book and you will find it addictive. And you will find you will start and you can't put it down. And you will find it's alluring and attractive, and you'll find that you can spend hours in the book. You just pass like that. But we want you to get into the book. Oh, we need it. I tell you, when I started preaching, and I was a young fella, and I trotted out a lot of nonsense on the platform, and you might say, you've been to Lurgan and nothing has changed. But nevertheless, There were older men, and they could never stand in a platform, and they could never preach a word, and they sat down for supper, and I tell you, they knew the book. Oh, they knew the book. I'm thinking of one old man, he was an engine driver. And he sat down, and he knew the book inside it, and he couldn't publicly preach a single word. And he would sit, and I tell you, it became very obvious to me that the men sitting listening to me knew more about the book than other men. And probably knew more about the book than I know now. Young brethren and sisters, assemblies were marked by being filled with folk who knew the book. Where is it going? Studying the scriptures is not just for preachers. And if you study it just to get a sermon, you're wasting your time. Why study it? Why you study it? Because it's only by studying it that you get to know the God behind the book. And Sodom's saying, I'll be finished in a couple of minutes. And he sacked the preacher on the last night.